Welcome to On The Money, where you can find out anything and everything to do with finance, business and the economy. On The Money is broadcast live from the studios of Radio 2 SER 107.3, nationwide on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and today coming up on the program...
A synchronised incentive to work that matches an opportunity for work.
Microfinancing is set to make a difference in Australia's marginalised communities. Grameen Australia is aiming to provide small loans to help individuals start up small businesses. All this coming up on The Money, so do stay tuned. First, we have new figures out from the Australian Bureau of Statistics, and for the first time in living memory, we see that we have negative inflation. So that's deflation, right? It means the prices on average went down. Now, this sounds good, but in terms of macroeconomics, it starts to ring alarm bells and economists start to get just a little bit edgy. So I asked UTS industry professor from the School of Business, Warren Hogan, just why economists would not be happy with a deflating economy.
Yeah, so deflation is essentially falling prices. And of course, this is a basket of a whole range of different goods and services across the economy, and some of them fell substantially, while others only fell a little bit, and some rose in the quarter. So the overall fall, I think, masks the fact that food and beverage rose, and most consumer items only fell a little bit. The big impacts were childcare and household furnishings and other household goods. So look, we've got a decline in prices in the quarter. But of course, we had a major economic shock in the quarter due to the shutdown of various parts of the economy. And the big question is really, is this the sort of the new normal? Is this what we should be expecting to see in the future, prices falling, or is this a one-off? And at the moment, I think we can safely say it's probably going to be a one-off.
But just thinking about prices falling, people sort of think, well, that's great, you know, everything's going to be cheaper. But economically, this is a problem, isn't it? Can you explain why?
Yeah, it is a bit counterintuitive, like many things in economics, to people with good common sense. But it is a bad thing that prices fall. It does reduce the cost of living. But the problem is that if falling prices more generally lead to falling wages, you can get yourself into a bit of a deflationary spiral, just like you could get into an inflationary spiral. And very much that was the case in the 1970s and in this country in the 1980s. So we're on the other side of that. And if we see wages fall and then prices fall again and wages fall, you know, it doesn't mean anyone's better off because they lose wages. And of course, the big issue and the reason it's a problem is that there's a lot of people who have debt, and the debt doesn't fall. So if your wages are falling, but your debt's still the same size, that's getting a bigger and bigger burden and harder to pay off. So in an economy that has a lot of debt, like Australia's, and I'm not talking about government debt, I'm talking about mortgages mainly, you want to avoid deflation. It's really can become economically disastrous. So that's why it's important to you know, watch this, because if this one-off fall in prices becomes another quarter, and then you see people's expectations for inflation fall or even go negative, and then people's wages start to fall, and you know, we have got a lot of unemployment now in this economy, that becomes a real problem. I don't expect that to happen, and neither does the government, but it's certainly a major thing to watch, and not just in Australia, all around the world.
And would that sort of thing, that's heading towards the subprime territory then, where you'd have people's mortgages being higher than the value of their houses, and then they would have had to have sold because their wages were going down and they couldn't afford the debt?
Well, that clearly becomes one of the potential problems, is that if people's wages start to come off because inflation expectations have fallen and because there is high unemployment and competition for jobs and this sort of thing, then one of the problems that could be emerged is that people do struggle to pay their mortgage or decide to sell their house. And then if that puts downward pressure on house prices, then you get into that problem of potentially more and more defaults. And again, it's this concept of a vicious cycle. And I don't see that as being a major risk right now because, well, I don't see this being a deflationary phase. I think we will move back to having positive inflation. But the transmission into the housing market is, again, something to watch because that market will probably be a little bit soft because of the high unemployment over the next year or so.
And so you're saying that it was the childcare which has been the big feature that's changed the figures for this time. But there was also a big drop in petroleum prices, wasn't there?
Yeah, so that we had what we watched for with these numbers is one-off factors because you can have, yeah, because inflation in this day and age is, you know, the overall movement of prices is very small. We've had inflation averaging just under 2% for the last 5 years. But individual items can move a lot, and petrol is obviously a big one that can move 10 or 15%. Fresh fruit and vegetables is often another thing we watch for volatility. So what us analysts, economists, and of course the Reserve Bank and the Treasury do is they try and strip away these one-off big movements and look at a concept of a core inflation, underlying inflation, or the actual measure they use from the ABS is called the trimmed mean. And that didn't fall anywhere near as much. I think it did fall in the quarter about 0.1%. And it is at a very, very low level in annual terms, but it didn't fall anywhere near as much. And of course, that's really telling us what the trend is. And, you know, hopefully that trend is to just temporarily down near zero and we get back up towards that sort of, you know, one or, yeah, well, the Reserve Bank's target's 2 to 3, which I think is overly ambitious for the next few years, but we certainly want to see the underlying inflation pulse in the economy start to pick up and go towards that 2% mark.
And so is the RBA still going to go ahead with quantitative easing?
Well, look, at this stage, they're not planning to. They're doing what some of us might call QE light. They actually don't call it QE. It's called yield curve control. And effectively, their whole policy approach for 30-odd years now has been to manage the overnight interest rate, to keep that at a level that they target, which has now fallen to what they regard as its low point of 0.25%. They're not prepared to go below that for good reasons, which I utterly agree with. But now the innovation since the pandemic has been to also target the 3-year interest rate, which they're targeting. The 3-year government bond is the sort of benchmark in the overall economy or financial system. And that's also at 0.25%. So essentially, they're trying to keep all interest rates out the 3 years maturity down at 0.25%. And they're doing that through buying and selling government bonds. But it's not really QE. They're still targeting a price. They're not putting a number of bonds on a quantity of bonds that they're going to buy. They're just putting a number on the interest rate and doing what they have to do to keep it there. I think the point you make, though, is that if this does start to look like we're getting into deflation, then what does the Reserve Bank do? Because at the moment, they've done all they really can do. But if prices are falling in the economy, there'll be a lot of pressure for them to do something more, and that could be QE. I don't think that's the discussion we're going to have until probably at the earliest, later in the year or early next year.
You're listening to On The Money, around Australia on the Community Radio Network. I'm Roderick Chambers, and we're just speaking here with UTS Business School's Industry Professor Warren Hogan about the figures that the ABS has just released on the state of the economy in the last quarter. with all the measures the government's taking, we're in sort of a twilight period in a way, and maybe we'll start to see a bit more what reality is going to look like in the fourth quarter of this year. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, so certainly the government has been very, very quick and, you know, very, very forceful with its fiscal emergency fiscal stimulus, the JobKeeper in particular, but also the extension of the JobSeeker and a range of other things. And I think one of the great modern military minds in the US called it overwhelming force. I think there's some elements of that here. We've thrown a lot at this economy now. And it's not, they can't keep spending this amount of money. It's just not sustainable. And of course, it does impede the functioning of the economy. It sort of attaches people to firms, the JobKeeper that is, and stops people, firms that are growing, being able to get hold of new staff and so forth. So it'll have to peel off. They're looking for a transition or a tapering of JobKeeper from October, from Q4, and for, you know, that tapering to occur through to March. And they're expecting it to be quite a significant taper. That is, they're expecting 2 of the 3.5 million people to come off it. So, we will get a better sense of where the economy is at then, but I think, you know, you're probably actually looking early 21, you know, early next year before you really get a sense of how bad the economy is. Because the other thing that's out there is the bank moratorium on interest repayments, and that's been extended to early 2021 as well. So we are in a bit of a phony war or a twilight, as you say, and it does tend to, you know, prop the economy
masking,
up a bit.
It's masking certain things, isn't it?
It is. Look, the big one is the extent of business failure. Both bank actions and also the JobKeeper are essentially keeping businesses going, that, you know, we just don't know how sustainable it is. And the health issue is still the primary issue. And we just, you know, we've got to get over that before we can really know what the economy is going to look like, particularly in those heavily affected areas. You know, are we going to go back to where we were in terms of hospitality, restaurants, arts and recreation, or are there shifts in people's behaviour that are going to take 5, 6, 7 years to sort of go back to where we were, sort of thing? So we are going to lose some businesses. And, you know, I think we'll probably get a clearer picture of that next year. So we're dragging it out to some extent, but we're trying to stop a sudden sort of almost collapse in economic activity and mass job losses. And they're doing a pretty good job of that. But it does mean that it'll take longer for us to get through to the other side.
And just finally, I just wanted to see what you thought about the China factor. We've been making statements about the South China Sea and so forth, which China is unhappy with. They've sort of had some sidelong comments about beef and wine imports, because they haven't mentioned iron ore, because they really need iron ore, I think, if I read the market correctly. How big a factor are we going to have with China for the rest of this year, do you think?
Look, at the moment, from an economic point of view, it's strongly beneficial. The iron ore price is very high. We've rarely seen it much higher than this. So it's generating a huge amount of income for Australia via those mining companies, which we do all benefit from through royalties and taxation and so forth. And you're right, they do need us, because we've got the world's largest known reserves of iron ore, and there's only a few countries in the world that have a lot of iron ore: Brazil, China themselves, Russia. China makes half the world's steel, and they need us. So I'm not too concerned about the iron ore story. But there is a geopolitical story, and we're heavily involved in that, whether we like it or not. And so we've got an extraordinarily tricky path to navigate between our trade relationship with them, and standing up for our values in the international community. So, look, I think in the next little while, the China story, I think, is not going to be a major influence, other than the positive influence it is. But that situation could deteriorate, especially if the Chinese start using the trade as a weapon, as a policy tool in a geopolitical sense. It will do damage to those areas. So whether it's the beef or the barley or what have you, they're quite small in terms of the overall economy, in terms of the overall trade relationship. but the individual businesses that are involved in that can be heavily negatively affected. And if they amp it up and do it to more products and more markets, then, you know, it is going to be disruptive. But at the moment, I don't think that's the major influence on our economy. We've got our own domestic challenges, as all do, as China does. China's got massive challenges to keep that economy growing, given their high expectations for growth over there. So it's a very, it's a tricky world. It's a tricky world, and that's going to be one of the big challenges for us for, you know, many, many years to come.
All right, Warren, thank you very much. I really appreciate you taking the time out to give us the benefit of your analysis here. Thank you very much.
My pleasure, Rod. All the best to you and your listeners.
Okay, thanks. Cheers. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Yes, UTS professor, industry professor from the School of Business there, Warren Hogan, speaking with me there.
On the Money, hedge your bets and stay tuned.
Rick Chambers, and you're listening to On the Money throughout Australia on the Community Radio Network. Well, Grameen Australia is a development foundation looking to bring microfinancing to Australia. Microfinancing gives small enterprises a much-needed cash boost to get started. Foundation is set to provide small loans to financially disadvantaged community groups working with the community to provide financial stability. And so how does this bring long-lasting financial stability to marginalised communities? Alfred Cho asked Adam Mooney, CEO of Grameen Australia, to describe how it all worked.
Grameen is an organisation that is the best-known microfinance organisation around the world. From Professor Muhammad Yunus, the Nobel Peace Prize winner in 2006, the model is now replicated by other microfinance organisations. And there are probably 300 million people around the world that have availed themselves of this unique program.
Could you explain to us exactly how Grameen goes about giving out loans to these groups of borrowers?
We will approach people and advertise in a particular locality, for example, Broadmeadows in Victoria, Fairfield in New South Wales, and maybe Inala in Brisbane or other parts, regional centres and remote communities. We will let people know that we've done our analysis and we think that this is a great place to for business enterprises to start up. We will then encourage, we will have a branch officer, a centre manager, and trainers and mentors that are ready to welcome clients. We'll then encourage one or two people that have come to us to start their own peer group and attract and bring together five people, talk about their business, develop a business plan, and then once the business plan is developed, to provide a loan of $1,000, $2,000, $5,000, or even $6,000, $7,000 to be able to buy the equipment that they need, to get the training that they need, or to buy the raw materials if they're involved in manufacturing and production. Each fortnight, we'll begin repaying the loan that they've taken out. And the loan, if it's, say, a $3,000 loan, it might take 6 months to pay back. The repayment period really is there to suit the client. It's not something that we, that will be over-onerous. We're also very flexible about looking at whether or not the income has been generated. We're starting to see, I think for a change, the banks being very flexible through necessity around loan repayments, but this is something that Grameen and other microfinance organisations have been very supportive of.
There are worries about microfinancing just becoming a debt trap for borrowers. How does Grameen manage repayments if people aren't able to meet them?
Yeah, absolutely. And they have there are many and varied case studies of where microfinance has had over-onerous repayment obligations and over-onerous and quite oppressive collection mechanisms. And this is often, there have been significant, this is particularly microfinance organisations that have been set up as private enterprises rather than community-oriented. There's a couple of instances in India in particular where very high interest rates were charged, particularly in Andhra Pradesh, one of the states there, where the Reserve Bank of India capped interest rates, and that meant that that put pressure on loan collectors to use inappropriate loan recovery techniques. Where Grameen is different is, first of all, the maximum you'll ever be charged, a person will ever be charged, is 12% per annum on the cost of finance. Secondly, the groups work together to support each other to make repayments and to for their business to be successful, to generate income, which is a very positive thing.
So how does Grameen intend to implement the model in Australia? Specifically, which community groups is it looking to help the most?
Our target group are people that are on low incomes, that don't have access to mainstream banking services and relationships. And the demographic analysis that we've done shows that the people that are overrepresented are women on low incomes in either Aboriginal communities or migrant communities, or involved in either, living with a disability or caring for someone with a disability. They're the three or four major groups that we're targeting, but we're equally making this available to particularly to all women on low incomes that want to start a business. The peer group lending model lends itself very, very well to Aboriginal communities where there's a collective identity around clan responsibilities and working together that are already happening. So that the great and attractive part of this model is that this complements culture rather than attempts to change culture through individual lending or sort of Western-oriented definitions of financial services.
And you mentioned that Grameen was focused on helping women. Does the microfinancing model offer benefits to female-led enterprise?
In particular, banking has tended to be a male-dominated industry, and design lending practices and processes that, oddly enough, seem to suit the people that work 5 days a week from 9 to 5. And where Grameen really reaches and impacts women positively is that by having a small business, being your own boss, means that you can do work from home, you can do work from whenever it suits. Women especially are involved in caring activities of elders or of with children and others. And the flexibility of running a small business and knowing when you have that great 3 to 4 hours of really productive work time and connecting in with others in your area to create this micro enterprise gives that flexibility, and it really optimizes time. Whereas we've seen over the last 10 years since the global financial crisis a significant casualization of the workforce, and it's meant that women are highly overrepresented in that casualization, and that means that incomes are less predictable. So having a small enterprise, being able to accelerate or decelerate the work to suit yourself, and also to be adaptive, you know, in local conditions, we're seeing that right now all around the world with the pandemic. We're seeing the need to hover over the brake and hover over the accelerator from time to time and respond to demand.
You mentioned microfinance is very suitable for the time period. A lot of marginalised groups are inevitably going to experience comparatively more economic hardship and financial instability due to the COVID pandemic. How does Grameen's microfinancing model offer assistance in this particular circumstance?
Pre-pandemic, there were 3 million Australian adults who were deemed to be severely or completely financially excluded. And you're absolutely right that the most marginalised in the community are the ones that are relatively worse off. And the reason that our time is right for us to enter Australia at Grameen is that we want to be able to, along with the government, but is to make sure that there is a synchronised incentive to work that matches an opportunity for work.
Adam Mooney, who is CEO of Grameen Australia, speaking there with Alfred Cho. And that's about it for On the Money this week. Tune in again next week to find out everything you need to know about finance, business and the economy. Thanks to producer Alfred Cho this week. On the Money is produced in the studios of Radio 2SER for the Community Radio Network and with the assistance of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. You can find all of our shows on 2ser.com/onthemoney. Subscribe to our podcasts. Follow us on Twitter. Look for @onthemoney2ser. And you can find us on Facebook and Instagram as well. I'm Roderick Chambers. We're going to be back again next week to give you the inside running on all things financial. Do stay well and thanks for your company.
School money!